Welcome to the Sean Morgan Report. I'm your host, Sean Morgan, and I have here my new friend, Matt Arrett. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
It's perfect.
Okay, great. Tell us a little bit about your background, and we'll get into this whole idea of the deep state versus the white hats and globalism versus national sovereignty.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, my background doesn't really, as far as education is concerned, it doesn't have anything to do with anything that I find of use that I have to contribute to the world at this point in time. Illustration, design, and fine arts was my sort of schooling. It was more a journey of personal discovery early on in the wake of 9/11. I think as most people had a similar experience, wanting to sort of get the bottom of what was really the truth. And I had started by putting together a documentary on 9/11 as part of a school project with a few friends. And you know, it didn't take long to do a little bit of digging and realize that that entire thing was a giant goose egg. It was a period of discovery, but I began to get more politically active at around 2006 when I started working with various organizations that were anti-war, anti-globalization, and I found myself organizing conferences, but still it wasn't really quite going anywhere. There was still a sense of what we should not do, but I didn't have a sense of, well, what should be done instead. So that was, again, something that was a bit of a journey. And in 2012, after doing some work on Canadian history, since I'm Montreal based, myself and some associates were trying to make sense of what was the environment we were working in here. Why is Canada a monarchy, for example, when all of the other parts of the Americas, all the way down to Argentina, everything else is a republic? So why are we a monarchy? And we started putting ourselves to work, trying to piece together a project that became a bit of a Canadian history research project, where we discovered that there was really never any sovereignty in Canada, that we were always a political operation designed and created for over 150 years to undermine the United States. So this also came with the idea that the United States itself was not just one USA. There was competing factions within the US history, within the power structures, over what would be the character of that nation down south. And one of the paradoxes that one encounters when you start looking at this is, why were there all of these American presidents who were assassinated? Not just four with bullets, but also another four with mysterious food poisoning. Was that all a coincidence? Was each one a separate case, or was there a unifying theme? And so when I came to the realization that no, in fact, all of them were all advocates fighting like hell against a Wall Street international City of London power structure that is global, that operates and controls much of Canada through the Privy Council, through Canada's deep state, which is much more, I would say, institutionally embedded than it is in the United States. In the US, you have the existence of more nationalistic, legitimate forms of institutions. And then you have this deep state thing on top of that. Whereas in Canada, it's more like the deep state thing is the institution.
They are subverting, the framework that we have, the guarantees, our human rights, our constitution. Whereas, Trudeau is like openly saying, I promise to keep everything secret from the Queen's Privy Council. I won't tell anyone about it.
You saw that, eh? Yeah, exactly. That's the oath of office that our prime minister takes.
Right. The Americans take an oath to the Constitution saying we the people are the true sovereigns, and Trudeau takes an oath that he will keep the secrets for the Queen.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it just goes to sort of shed light in my mind, it helped me make sense of what it is that what is the role of Canada within a broader chemistry globally? Because everyone that I was encountering who were seen as experts were always trying to nitpick Canada or comment on Canada's history as authorities within a vacuum, as if it was maybe just Canada or Canada and the United States, Canada fighting against the big bad USA empire, but they would never put it within a proper geopolitical global context, since we are always a branch of the British Empire. I mean, like you just said, anybody listening right now to this interview, they can just go and Google Justin Trudeau Privy Council Oath. Just do that on YouTube and just listen to this disgusting thing. Every single prime minister and cabinet member, as well as members of the private sector too, make this oath as part of a very elite clique that are highly controlled by a technocratic oligarchy To be operatives. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody who is a privy councillor is intrinsically part of the machine in the same way. There have been some, and I've written about that in my book series on the untold history of Canada. There have been some who have stepped out of line, you know, and they paid the price. But all that to say, there is a much deeper controlling hand. And going back to the U.S. presidents, the common theme was nationalism, a sense of invoking national banking, or a sense of emitting long-term national credit through Treasury Act of some form for the purpose of building large-scale infrastructure that would both create free enterprise on the one hand, while at the other hand, elevate people to higher standards of life and really, you know, support the general welfare. And this is where we're talking here. We can go to Zachary Taylor, Harrison, 1840, who died after 3 months, had a program to revive the Third National Hamiltonian Bank on his desk. Was part of the whole Lincoln, John Quincy Adams network. He died. Then, 10 years later, you had Zachary Taylor die. Then you had Lincoln die. Then you had McKinley. But before McKinley, you had Garfield. Then after McKinley, you had, 20 some odd years later, you had 1923 Warren Harding. Again, another Lincoln Republican who was fighting against this machine. Very underrated. Only in there for about 3 years. FDR died before he could complete his term in office, where he had a vision to break the British Empire, break up the controls of Wall Street, which he had done throughout the 1930s, and bring about development for everybody as a win-win system of global cooperation. He died April 12th before he could get really that international program online. And then obviously everyone knows JFK, and I would say I would throw his brother in, Bobby, who was going to become the presidential, the president, I mean, guaranteed in 1968. He had won the Democratic primaries. He was a shoo-in until, this thing eliminated him too. So all that to say, that's what got me into it. The Canadian Patriot magazine I started as a platform to disseminate a lot of this research, because I couldn't really find anyone who was courageous enough to publish it outside of that. So I had to create a platform. And more recently, I created the Rising Tide Foundation with my wife, Cynthia Chung, who's also a writer with me at Strategic Culture.
Well, that's good. Your introduction really got halfway into the conversation that I wanted to get into, which is to identify the sides of this unconventional war that's happening before our eyes, you know, and what the principles are that each side believes in. And in your other interview, you also identified eugenics and transhumanism as being two things that the deep state side or the globalist side, this part of their philosophy. And for the side that I call the white hats, it's that national sovereignty, the freedom, the economic prosperity, power to the people, let the regular people have a little bit of choice, a little bit of freedom, a little bit of higher standards. Let's talk about some of the organizations and institutions that are related to each side. So you talked in your other interview about the Kissinger and Davos, you know, some of these like World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, Bank of International Settlements seem to be a really big one. Maybe you can give us a top down. What are the most important or biggest institutions or most central to the globalist side? Is the Bank of International Settlements really high on that list of an important institution for them?
Oh yeah, sure. As a mechanism, it's quite important. It's sort of for those who don't know, it's the central bank of central banks that was created by Montague Norman and a coterie of other central bankers in 1930. Montague Norman was at the time a big eugenicist and the head of the Bank of England. And in 1930, the reason why nominally it was created was to facilitate debt repayments from Germany to the victor nations of World War I. That was nominally the reason. The other reason was, and we saw that immediately in 1932. 1932 is still the period where the Depression, there was no hope for a cure for the Depression in the minds of most people that had been waged already for about over 3 years since 1929. The idea was to create an instrument that could consolidate power away and take power away from nation states, which had formerly enjoyed the sovereign right of emitting credit, and put it into the hands of a consolidated central banking community that was above nation states. Now, of course, in various nations, whether it's Britain or in the case of the Federal Reserve in the United States, you did have central banking mechanisms in place, but it wasn't that well coordinated more broadly. So this is why this was done. And in 1932, the Bank of International Settlements, along with the League of Nations, which were both City of London creations, were, and I mean, largely they were created by a group named the Roundtable Movement. It was an endowment set up with the money by Cecil Rhodes when he died, this race patriot eugenicist who ran Zimbabwe and much of South Africa. But anyway, that money was put together in a trust that funded the creation of think tanks called the Roundtable Movement in various parts of the Anglo-Saxon Commonwealth. The Council on Foreign Relations being the American branch that was set up in 1921. But this group, and they also created a scholarship program to better brainwash their...
The Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a new way, a new technique, or a more refined technique of finding talent from around the empire, brainwashing them, or at least giving them a special type of elitist education that would give them a series of experiences that would put their minds in a certain mission orientation, very indoctrinated wise, and then redeploy them back into whatever part of the world that they come from to basically advance and coordinate a multi-generational plan if need be.
They're operatives.
Yeah, exactly. And again, just like I've said about the Privy Councillors, I don't like generalizing things too radically, because I have found examples of Rhodes Scholars who have stepped out of line. Okay, now it doesn't mean that you're necessarily, totally not yourself necessarily, but usually, yes, you are.
It's designed to be an operative recruitment tool, but some people, decide to be their own person. Okay, so... this brings me to a contradiction that I did want to discuss, which is this idea that you had Cecil Rhodes. He believed that the Anglo genetics were just the best in the world, and like the white people should rule and all that stuff. And yet you have this Davos crowd, World Economic Forum, and all these people, these eugenicists, who it seems like they've made white people enemy number one. So which is it? Do they think white people are the master race and they want them to rule over other people? Or are they trying to destroy the white race and destroy Western civilization, destroy the white family, and make white people hate themselves? Which one is it? I mean, how do you wrestle with that contradiction?
It's not really a contradiction when you realize that a lot of the ideology, because it's about ideology. This is a game. It's a battlefield of the mind. And the topography of where this battlefield is being waged is in the realm of concepts and ideas, because the ideas are the immaterial metaphysical force that shapes our identities, that shapes our planning, what we think is possible. What we think is possible is is the space we're going to navigate in. If we don't think certain things are possible, we just won't even try to do things, which is exactly how we're corralled into a slaughterhouse. So that's really where it works. And when you realize that the people promoting things like critical race theory and a lot of the other contaminating ideas that have been permeating over generations, increasingly our educational system, as well as every cultural institution, those who are actually promoting it themselves are absolutely racist. They themselves don't believe in the ideologies that they're spreading, that they're trying to get the victims, which is pretty much the majority of the people, to self-cannibalize.
Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. Exactly. And so
this eugenics thing, they don't have like this great loyalty to everyone in their own race. Right. They don't love white people, obviously, if they consider most white people to be pawns in their schemes.
Oh, it's not I mean, for them, there is racism at the top. I mean, you do have radical social Darwinistic controlling beliefs at the top of the pyramid, where you start looking at some of these older family structures and bloodlines. Yeah, like you won't find the royal family of Prince Philip or anything contaminating their bloodlines with darker races in general. That you just won't see that. If you like open up the books of peerage that are published that sort of like document the family bloodlines publicly, people could just access these. You don't see a permission. It's a very inbred sort of ethic that goes off. So they are very racist. And if you look at a lot of the policies that they put into place, a lot of the especially cultural relativism theories that have really permeated a lot of Western society and even a lot of the colonized parts of the world, there is this idea that every nation there is no truth, right? There's no universals, there's no principles, there's no common truths anywhere. Everybody is different because every culture is different. And so they'll say, okay, people like John F. Kennedy, who are talking about developing hydroelectric dams and advanced science programs for Ghana and for Africa, that was wrong because they were disrespecting the natural cultural ecosystems of African nations, which are anti-science. That's their place. They don't like science. That's, you have to respect them. So you have these liberals who start speaking in a way which makes them sound as though they're very respectful of countries and indigenous populations because we don't want to contaminate them with the pollution of technology and science. But in reality, it's very racist. It's very racist because you're basically, it's technological apartheid. You're basically saying that we, that this science is something that the white races have done, and that's bad because it destroys nature. But in fact, it's, that's why we have an average life expectancy today of like 80 plus years of age, whereas people in much of Africa, sub-Saharan, might be lucky to live till, you know, 40 on average. Because of the science technology, these things are not from, yes, we did that in white cultures, that we did technology and stuff, but so did they in different parts of history. It's something that all human beings can do. It just expresses itself in different languages and cultural expressions. So I would say if you again, go to people like Prince Bernhard, Prince who founded the Bilderberger Group, Prince Philip, a lot of these upper level elites, they are absolutely, absolutely racist. And they do want to create a, when they talk about reducing the world population to like 1 billion or less, according to some computer models, they do want the biggest pain to be felt by the darker skinned nations of the world. That's their core thing. And when it comes to like dumb white people who are useful tools, yeah, they'll have us, they'll have us just, you know, self-hate to the ends of the earth. But it ends up hurting, you know, Black Americans as well as white Americans equally when you look at the effect of a lot of the critical race theory overall.
So let's keep on identifying these institutions that are deep state controlled from a top level down. So I mentioned the Bank of International Settlements. I don't know how central that is to their structure. What are some other groups that you think are really important for people to know about?
Well, just to say quickly on the Bank of International Settlements, one of the biggest things, Mark Carney, who was the former head of the Bank of England and the Bank of Canada before that, who's a Goldman Sachs man, but really is just a high level technocrat. His former gig was running the Financial Stability Board, which is a department in the Bank of International Settlements. Before he was running that department, it was Mario Draghi, who is currently the Prime Minister of Italy. Another one of these green technocrats setting us up for a big green kill at COP26. The Financial Stability Board is the regulator of global derivatives. Now, if people want to know how the time bomb has been set up into our financial system to, and I recently wrote an article, how the economy became a time bomb, which goes through the fact that when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, when De Gaulle was ousted in 69, and I'm going to get back to your question on the institutions, I promise. You had a relative coup on an institutional level where the Trilateral Commission was formed in 73, but before that you had Kissinger, you had a lot of these, Zbigniew Brzezinski, all set up with David Rockefeller, who was the head of Chase Manhattan. They set up a group that became, again, the Trilateral Commission. It ran much of US policy and enforced this transformation in the 1970s when the dollar was removed from the gold reserve standard and was floated onto the global markets. So the price of value of the value of the US dollar was no longer tied to anything of physical, measurable, productive economics. It wasn't, which it formerly was. After it was floated, it became increasingly tied to the fluctuating prices of oil on the spot markets. This is where the petrodollar that Kissinger engineered came in. It became tied to just whatever speculators wanted to pay, which had no bearing necessarily on the well-being of the nation as a whole, which it must. If capitalism is going to function, you have to have a connection between the price, the value of your dollar, and what is your nation doing to improve quality of life. If you don't have that connection, and it's severed, as happened in 71, and then deregulation, the era of globalization took over, then you're in a situation where it's a time bomb. And the way that worked was the creation of fictitious capital. The name for that increasingly became, under Greenspan, derivatives. The basically insurance on securitized forms of debts of an infinite variety of degrees.
Just really abstraction upon abstraction of these markets, right?
You got it. And today, these things outnumber at something like 40 times the global GDP in terms of like nominal asset, which is, it's all going to default. It's a fake. When people think that they have value in the system, it's mostly fake. Very little of it is tied to reality. So that's the bomb that people like Mark Carney were set up to manage. And that's the Bank of International Settlements.
And this is kind of like a form of black magic, isn't it? Because it's only a particular priest class of people who can even wrap their heads around the complexity and abstraction of it all. So, and then, you know, there are people that try to obviously profit off of it, these insiders on Wall Street and so forth, the Goldman Sachs people.
They called Alan Greenspan the Oracle, right? Because he was the only one who could like tell the tea leaves of these mathematical formula.
So do you think they understand what they're doing? Do you think that it's kind of like they created a monster that they can't control anymore, though?
I mean, there is a science to the chaos. And I mean, the idea of blowing out the system was part of the design going back to, you know, like when Maurice Strong, who was he's a co-founder of the World Economic Forum. That was another institution created in 1971. It had a different name, but Klaus Schwab is the nominal sort of head. But Klaus Schwab was just a student at Harvard under Kissinger in 66, 67. So he was just, you know, selected as a front man early on to be the manager of this thing. But the co-founder of it was somebody who was a little bit more self-aware of what they were a part of, a Canadian privy councillor, Maurice Strong, whom Klaus Schwab described as my mentor. Now, Strong recently passed away. But he had a deep legacy. And when he talks about the responsibility, you know, in 1991, there's this interview that I took an excerpt from in my new article, which people, if they go to the CanadianPatriot.org, they can read this article on the how the economy became a time bomb. But he talks about the elites at Davos, how it's their responsibility to bring about the disintegration of industrial civilization to save the environment. That it's their responsibility. So yes, that part of what we're experiencing is part of a design, but at the other hand too, there's a bit of folly and incompetence as well, because this is the sort of thing that you could imagine looks good on paper, maybe if you're like an oligarchical sort of game planner, you know, writing about scenarios in 1960s, 70s, and it might look good. Okay, we're going to do these things, and it's very intricate. You know, there's many moving parts to this, so it does take a little quality of evil genius, I would say. But when it comes to the actual reality of what this disintegration actually does, not only to the victims but also to those who are trying to manage the chaos can't be managed that way. And I mean, I often use this example of the paradox of if Wall Street and if the city of London were all financing fascism, Mussolini and Hitler, you know, which they were provably so throughout the 20s and 30s. That's where George Bush's family fortune came from, was financing primarily Hitler through Brown Brothers Harriman and union banking. Why was it that they had all ended up fighting Hitler and Mussolini? What was that about? Was that all just a game? And it's like, when you start digging into it, you realize that no,
Things didn't go according to plan, right?
Things didn't go according to their formula. And these
psychopathic people, they're not exactly the most loyal allies, are they? So they'll stab you in the back. And I wanted to get into the idea that maybe the CCP allied themselves with this Davos crowd for a long while as beneficiaries. And now they've gotten so powerful that maybe they've decided to stab them in the back and go rogue. Because you've got George Soros and the president of China exchanging insults very recently. So it makes you wonder, is the CCP even on the same team with this, the rest of the deep state anymore? But let's save that, because I still want to know.
That's a good question.
who is the deep state? Because you've mentioned, you know, the Bilderberg, Trilateral Commission, World Economic Forum, Bank of International Settlements, but top down, what do you think is really important for people to understand?
The simplest way of putting this is it's the British Empire. Okay. This used to be easier for people to understand in the 19th century. So that
includes City of London, monarchy.
Yeah. I mean, it's a multifaceted thing, but it basically is like the when the American Revolution was fought, right? If you read the writings of Benjamin Franklin, you look at the type of environment that the founding fathers were operating in terms of, it wasn't just a militia fight against the world's biggest military power. The military power was not the empire. It was an aspect of it that subdued, you know, India and all these things, but it wasn't the empire. It was understood by the founding fathers and many others around the world who were helping the founding fathers, including, you know, Catherine the Great, including Scharnhorst. I mean, Marquis de Lafayette, you had some incredible figures who are working with Ben Franklin to make this happen as an international movement. That's the first chapter of my new book, actually. Also, India. I mean, the Mysore Rebellion was run by Hyder Ali, a Muslim leader of southern India, who was waging war at the same time during the American Revolution against the British, and he was writing letters to the Continental Congress, writing that we have the same fight for the same dream is what we're fighting for. And he absorbed 20% of the British military that had to fight him instead of going to America, which is what the British original plan was, which probably tipped the balance in favor of the revolutionaries. That's a fun one for people to chew on. So all that to say, they understood that you had the military aspect, you had the City of London, just like today. It's back then, it was still the financial nerve center of the world. That's how the empire was able to maintain control over, you know, the sun never sets. That's the old adage. Then you had intelligence. Now, I'd say the most important aspect of this was what was the British Empire. Here, I have to do context. I'm sorry. I always have to do context. But the British Empire and the City of London, the Bank of England as a private central bank, was not the world's first, but it was set up in 1688. Before that, there was a Republican movement in Britain itself on the island, which was anti-oligarchical. It was trying to fight to revive the spirit of Erasmus, of Thomas More, of Henry VII. Which was a real Republican spirit of nation building, anti-imperialism, that mostly got crushed in the Glorious Revolution, when you had the takeover, the Dutch-Phoenician takeover of England and the installation of William of Orange and the creation of the Bank of England. That was modeled on a previous bank called the Bank of Amsterdam, which was technically the world's first private central bank. That was a new instrument. But even that was itself modeled on the previous Bank of Venice, which was even before that. That was the actual first one. People think it was Amsterdam, it was actually Venice. So the Venetian system, this was the center of control globally for about 800 or so years after the Roman Empire fell. Venice was the center of a lot of evil that people, even today, they don't know how to think about. But this is what largely, it almost was wiped out in 1509. During what's called the League of Cambrai, where the nations who were fighting each other all actually just stopped fighting for a second. They all talked and they realized, wait a minute, we're all being induced to fight by the intelligence being provided to us through ambassadors from Venice. All of our armies are getting loans from the same Venetian banks, which had the control of global bullion. They had the monopoly over Mongol territory. They were probably giving Mongolian hordes intel on when they invaded different parts of the Western world. So they're like, why are we doing this? It seems like Venice is the one that's like acting like our Iago, whispering in all of our ears, getting us to fight each other. That's what Shakespeare was talking about in Othello, and the Merchant of Venice, actually. So they wiped out Venice's military, and before they could go in for their final sweep, basically Venice did something I don't fully understand, but they basically got the league to disintegrate, where within months, everybody who was part of the league who had wiped out the Venetian fleets all started fighting each other and working with Venice as their friend. It was weird. But that was like a wake-up call, where the Venetians realized they needed a better base of operations instead of the armpit of Italy, the lagoons. They decided they needed to find better, more safe strategic areas to set themselves up, which became
like the island of Great Britain.
And that's why they call it the Dutch Anglo. So part of it is like Prince Bernhard is, you know, the founder of the Bilderberger Group. He's the Dutch prince, but he always worked very closely with his cousin Prince Philip from the Isles. But all that to say, yeah, I mean, that became more the zone of control. Now, I'm saying all of this because the question is, what were the founding fathers up against? And it was intelligence. That was the same. The British intelligence was using the Venetian techniques of profiling, of running a psyops, counterintelligence. And, you know, people like Benjamin Franklin as well had to engage in a lot of counterintelligence as well, which is largely misunderstood today. So it's a multifaceted thing, but I would say in the current age, the expression of that is maybe a bit different, but it's the same thing in essence. It's MI5, MI6 set up at the beginning of the 20th century.
Five Eyes, right? It's really, it goes beyond.
Well, the Five Eyes became the consummation of Cecil Rhodes's call in his 1877 will to recapture the United States and create a new global church of the British Empire. But it was, you know, the Five Eyes is, yeah, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the USA and Britain together that consolidated a signals intel sharing system with controls in London. And that was after World War II that really got ingrained. Because before that, in World War II, there was still a nationalistic patriotic intelligence service under the OSS that still had an anti-imperial program about it. That was purged when the OSS was disbanded. A lot of the patriots were all declared red commie scum, and their lives were ruined. And the dirtiest traitors around Alan Dulles were the ones who were kept in as part of the new CIA that was formulated in 47 under Truman. And it was, you know, so you had this whole thing, but that's really, I would say today, if you want to look at where are the controlling mechanisms, you do have to look at some of the thought control centers like Cambridge, the Royal Society, the Royal Society is a big one as well, as far as like setting up epistemological space and master grand strategy. But then in terms of the active expression, yeah, I mean, still MI6, MI5 within Britain itself are very important aspects of what coordinates U.S. intelligence agency, NSA, CIA operations. Here I am in Canada, and same sort of beast is running CSIS. So I'd just say, you know, it's
that British globalist thing.
Yeah, you really want to, British globalist thing, but you really got to look at the ideology of it. Okay, the ideology is that this system, what organizes it is a commitment to a certain set of core axiomatic assumptions about the nature of human beings, the nature of law, natural law, that are immutable. In their view, there is no qualitative difference between animals of the jungle and human beings. The monkeys and humans, are just a linear expression of more of a form
it's
of monkey.
It's godless.
We're made in the image of
their life. View is godless.
It's godless, and it's based on, yeah, essentially that the only thing that characterizes us is maybe we got like bigger thumbs, you know, or maybe a slightly more advanced prefrontal cortex that allows us to maybe lie a bit better, you know, than animals do. But and also the idea that it's a closed system, because we're animals of that sort, there's no qualitative idea of a human beings made in the image of a divine creator as a creative force or an instrument for good. That doesn't exist in their equations. So in their world, because we are these expressions of just other animals in ecosystems, we, just like the other animals, live in relatively closed systems defined by their genetic and environmental characteristics. So, you know, I use this example a lot. A rabbit population will grow to the degree that there is abundance in nature. If you've got good rain seasons and harvests, a lot of food to be eaten, rabbits will reproduce. And when you have a drought, their populations will collapse. The mommies will eat the babies, and it will just regulate itself. That's just what nature does. That's not bad or good. It's just, that's what rabbits do that. With human beings, we could feasibly discover that there are periodic droughts. We could plan ahead by putting some food aside. We could do drought control. We could do, you know, desalination of water. So we can, using the power, this metaphysical power of creative thought, of reason, we can discover the laws of the universe, translate them into forecasting when things will happen, and plan accordingly, according to future states. And the more we develop that sense of reasoning, the deeper into the future our minds can plan that shape our present actions, right? And the deeper into the past our minds can penetrate. Animals don't have like great-great-grandparent stories. So we can do that, and we can then modulate and coordinate the chosen development path of our identities, as well as our national policies, according to deeper lessons into the both directions, past and future. So this is what the empire is afraid of. And they're committed to the idea that, no, we live in a closed system. What I just said is not part of their equation, because they like control. So they want us to adapt like other animals to a controlled environment, a controlled what that, and they're the ones who control the conditions of the environment, right? That we behaviorally fit ourselves into. And from that closed system, there's a limited amount of resources that we can fight over that give us diminishing returns as we, as our population continues to expand, right? There's less resources to go around, that creates a tension. Those tension points are then utilized by the scientific managers of society back in the 19th century or even 18th century. They were the Malthusians. They were the followers of the logic of Malthus's law of population. He was a teacher at the British Haileybury School that taught all of the economists for the British East India Company, the British Empire. And the idea was, okay, to scientifically manage, we have to take this equation, population and resources, right? They always create tension, and then utilize the gifts God gave us of drought, pandemic, wars, to encourage the depopulation of your Irish or Indian populations to accommodate the overpopulation, the calculable overpopulation points. So it's the same thing today. When you have the Trilateral Commission take over in the 70s, when you have the World Economic Forum, people like Henry Kissinger, Maurice Strong, they are all believers that Malthus was right. That's why they are called Neo-Malthusians. It was a Neo-Malthusian takeover, and their job was to put limits to growth, to destroy the ethic that formerly animated the best of the United States, that scientific and technological progress are blessings. This is how we come into communion with God, would be by discovering God's laws in the book of nature and translating those things to new types of technology that would allow us to overcome the limits to growth that are always there, but we can leap out of them. And we could share that with our neighbor and pull the poor of the world out as well to dignity. So that's what they had to crush with the killing of Kennedy, with the killing of Bobby, with the killing of Martin Luther King, the ousting of De Gaulle, who had a similar sort of ethical spirit, and bring in this new type of idea that no, small is good. Be at one with nature, live in the moment. Don't live in the now. Don't think of the future. Don't think of the past. Just be. All of this type of shit just was really, really ingrained with the help of a lot of drugs and LSD. You know, people like Timothy Leary was of an assist to sort of create a new cultural environment where these young people born after World War II grew up in a totally schizophrenic world of unnecessary, insane, Dulles funded wars in Vietnam. You know, so they were much more willing as a young generation to break all ties with the past. Don't trust anybody over 30 and jump into this rock, suck, sex, drugs counterculture. And if you look at where did the LSD come from, that was spread all over the campuses by Ken Kesey, right? He was part of the CIA MK Ultra. Timothy Leary, the drug guru, was recruited by Aldous Huxley, who was a British high level. I mean, he was doing the same role that his grandfather Thomas Huxley was doing, Darwin's bulldog. You know, Aldous was deployed to California to set up much of Hollywood's scripts in the 30s after doing Brave New World. And he recruited Timothy Leary, and Timothy Leary said, if it wasn't for the CIA, I wouldn't be who I am. He loves the CIA. So it's like, this is, it's a tough pill for a lot of people, especially who lived through that, baby boomers who lived through that experience. It's a tough pill to swallow, but they got to swallow it because there was some good. It was good that you wanted to get together and express, you know, love and not war and to fight the Vietnam. Those are all good things, but I'm sorry, a lot of it was co-opted. And it was rechanneled into something that became a fertile soil for such things like critical theory today.
Looking back, you can see how it caused the decay, moral decay, and different things to actually divide and conquer us. Mm-hmm. So going at a high level here on the psychology of the deep state, it's this kind of a psychopathic thing where they need to have control. They can't stand the idea of just letting go and letting God and nature take its place. They just need to get in there with the puppet strings and try to control different variables, because the idea of being out of control is just they can't stand that idea for some reason. And they believe in the survival of the fittest, that this is all a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. And that they're at the top and they have to keep destroying everyone below them, or else someone might destroy them, right?
Kind of, yeah, that's right. And it is epistemological. I mean, some of this you know, we often look for like, well, what is the reason for evil, you know, and it's a good question to ask, like, where does evil come from? What drives evil? What causes people who are born good? You know, babies are born good. What would cause them to become a Henry Kissinger or a Zbigniew Brzezinski or somebody even higher? And I think it helps to look at some of the insights that are contained in some literary things that are pieces of art that we often don't think of this way. But I mentioned briefly William Shakespeare's Othello or his Merchant of Venice. As far as like a psychological analysis of oligarchical thinking and feeling, what makes it tick, those you can only do it sometimes in the form of art. Edgar Allan Poe also takes you into the mind of the self-destructive nature of this evil thing. If you read his Fall of the House of Usher or Mask of the Red Death, I'm hoping people are writing these things down, but these are really good little short stories that, again, give you a good insight into the psychological, weird, inside-out world. But it's reasonable. You can understand the irrationality of it all. But they are committed to, like you said, a Darwinistic... I mean, this is why Darwin is created. You know, I wrote a piece not that long ago getting at how Darwin himself, his theories that are celebrated as being these just incredible, like Isaac Newton, like the best theories of the world coming out of this guy, right? That explain human nature, life, the universe, and everything. And so it's finally Darwin in 1859 did it. And no, it's actually, he even writes in his autobiography that his discovery, his model for describing the evolution of new species came from his reading of Thomas Malthus's Essays on Population when he was on the Beagle. And he was like reading that. And he's like, then I had a theory by which to work was this idea of the race for diminishing returns, where only the strong survive, the weak die out. And that somehow that tension, he said, okay, that is what allows for the creation of like a bigger claw or
so
whatever.
So it's just a biological version of his economics philosophy.
Yes, exactly. And yeah. They needed that. That's why the Empire was putting so much effort into promoting Darwinian biological theory, because it justified their immoral expanse over India and what the world was pretty disgusted by the, you know, mid to late 19th century of what the British Empire had intended to do and did to the Irish under the potato famine, the controlled famines under India to check population. This was like people were pretty aware of a lot of this stuff. And so Britain was like, well, how do we justify this? Because it's really tough in a Christian-dominated ethic to justify why we do what we do, including to our own people. Like even people amongst the British members of parliament were getting kind of like grossed out. And there were fights inside of the British parliament saying like, let's just disband the empire. And people were actually fighting. You could read transcripts where there was fights over like, let's break up the empire. This is going against our Christian doctrine. We can't live with ourselves. And the British, you know, high command was freaking out. They're like, well, how do we maintain the system? And so they needed something to satisfy the intellectual hunger that people have to because we want to justify things, right? That's the human mind always wants to find reason for things. And so Darwin became a good way of saying, look, nature as a whole is built this way. This is not inconsistent with natural law. In fact, we are doing the bidding. We don't believe in God, but we believe in these laws, right, of random mutations that cause qualitative changes that induce the weak to be beaten out by the strong or subdued. So that became that. And throughout the 20th century, there was modifications on the Darwinian theory. Some of it was taken up by Julian Huxley, who created transhumanism. So the idea, the word transhumanism came from Thomas Huxley's. And again, Darwin couldn't defend himself in public. He was incompetent, kind of like Isaac Newton was incompetent at defending his own theories in public. So he needed controllers, like in the case of Newton, it was who is by all intents and purposes an autistic, useful tool whose ideas were basically the product of theft of other people who actually were creative scientists, like Leibniz or Kepler or Huygens, but that's another story. Anyway, just like that, Darwin also required his defenders like Thomas Huxley to do all of the work debating things publicly, whereas he couldn't put it into words properly. So Thomas Huxley's kids, I mean, you know, it was there's a little mini dynastic sort of family privilege given to that upper level managerial sort of group. And Julian co-created with a few others, Haldane, GBS Haldane being one of them, and H.G. Wells being another. This idea of neo-Darwinism, the new synthesis in the 20s, because a lot of scientists were realizing that, well, Darwin's not, that is not explaining the fact that there are these creative leaps. We don't find any cases of gradualism the way Darwin demands be found, of like species just gradually changing. What we find are these discontinuous, discrete leaps in fossil records. We also see this in human society. Whenever human beings make a new discovery, like electricity that we bring online, we don't have like a gradual increase of the potentials of productive powers that just gradually grow from the pre-electricity society. It's like a quantum leap of new potential because of the new discovery. And so a lot of scientists in the 20s were having problems with Darwin. So, and also directionality, right? That there's a directed flow towards perfectibility in nature. That's something that Darwin denies. You don't get that in his theory. In his theory, it's just random. It's just change. So they had to come up with a new type of repackaging of Darwinism. And that was Julian Huxley's job. That became, as I said, new synthesis. People like Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit priest, played a role in this with the Piltdown Man hoax, but also the creation of a neo-transhumanist eugenics. And so transhumanism became the new neo-eugenics for the elite. So you had a popular eugenics that's promoted by people for, like, you know, Dawkins, for example, is like a popularizer of the low-level eugenics. Eugenics too. But the low-level Darwinism for the masses to believe. And then you have the upper one where people who are part of the, you know, the Davos crowd, for example, are brought into the church of the transhumanist new synthesis doctrine. Like Yuval Harari is a big transhumanist who believes this, or the Kurzweil, the Google, you know, engineer. But I think most of them, people like Bill Gates, Elon Musk, a lot of the people who are part of that upper level crowd are all indoctrinated into that type of false religion. It's kind of like what Timothy Leary had called a scientific paganism, which is what he and Aldous Huxley co-created. And he discusses that, Timothy Leary, in his 1983 autobiography. The need to replace Christianity and monotheism more generally with a new scientific paganism.
Well, now they're really getting ambitious, right? Because they're going after the afterlife, you know, with Elon Musk's Neuralink, for example, trying to transfer consciousness, you know, from a human to a computer, to some type of hybrid kind of thing that can just live forever. Cloud, it seems like right? a real cloud. It's a real obsession for Peter Thiel and Elon Musk and a lot of these billionaires to live forever, because they deny the natural cycles of consciousness and the soul and all of that. Okay, so we talked about this ego-based, selfish type of philosophy of the deep state, and it's kind of British, royal, City of London, the money masters. That's all part of them. And then let's talk about the counterforce. So obviously the Americans, with, you know, fighting against them and setting up their own kind of power center. And then New York kind of took some of the power from the City of London. You had Washington D.C. and all of the military power that could potentially go against the British. And but there's been kind of like a hybrid where half of the American system has been allied with the British, like the CIA have been allied with the MI6, for example. And then you've had a few of these presidents that you've mentioned that have tried to go against this globalist system, but they haven't been too successful. It's kind of these temporary attempts. But let's talk about some of the groups and institutions that you see as a major counterforce. And one of them that I want to mention is Putin and Russia. And just wondering if you could talk about when you're looking at the really, really high level of the groups like the CCP and so forth that are really, really have a high impact level for this unconventional warfare. You know, you've got some of these nation states with a whole bunch of nukes, and you can't deny that they can have a big impact in a worldwide conflict. Oh, yeah. So I'm wondering where you see Putin and his alliances, or is he more of a kind of a guy, he's all on his own. He's going to just, you know, choose whichever side is more convenient at a certain time. Who are the major counter forces to the deep state on the world stage?
Which folds in a little bit to your previous question that you alluded to a little bit earlier on the CCP. Okay, so yeah, that's a great question, by the way. I really appreciate that question. The issue with Russia is tied to the issue with China. You can't really look at just one or the other because both have a strategic alliance that became formally outlined in a 2015 agreement to merge the Belt and Road Initiative with Russia's Eurasian Economic Union. So the Eurasian Economic Union is about six countries: Armenia, Azerbaijan, not Azerbaijan, sorry, Kazakhstan, Russia, forgetting all of a sudden a few others. Anyway, it's not the European Union, right? This is Eurasian Economic Union, and it's premised around a certain set of political economic ideas that are not consistent with the IMF, World Bank, sort of transatlantic community cage that we live in. There you actually have the construction of infrastructure as a priority over speculation, for example. So that merged with the China-led Belt and Road Initiative, and that's been continuously creatively evolving and integrating ever more with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you know, the security architecture that has Russia and China and India, as well as the foundation stone. Iran and Pakistan have both become full members. There's many others who are part. They're looking at other Afghanistan potentially joining. Russia has dealt with something really bad. So in the 90s, they were nearly totally annihilated. When Gorbachev, who was always this sort of a technocratic asset, was deployed to take over and deconstruct Russia in a certain way. The idea was to bring in now the New World Order. This is where you get George Bush Sr. You know, a lot of these freaks in 1991, 92, all celebrating the New World Order is here. You can listen to their speeches on YouTube. And that's what they were talking about. That's what Francis Fukuyama was talking about with his end of history. Like, you know, the idea was the Cold War is now over. Russia is now disintegrating. And we only have one center of power. That's going to be the history is defined by tension and nations doing things. Now that's over. We don't have any opposition. Everybody's going to fall into line, and that's what he says is the end of history. Test two babies, all that Brave New World shit, right? But it didn't really work out that way, because Russia actually still had, during the decade of perestroika, of privatizations, the creation of a London controlled oligarchy of nouveau riche in Russia. That was all created in a very, very quick fashion in the 90s, but there were still patriotic elements in high position that were waiting to fight back, which they did finally when they ousted Boris Yeltsin, who was a drunkard whore who only did destruction. And this is where Primakov played a very important patriotic role as a sponsor of a young Putin who had talent, but you know, nobody really knew. He was playing a very smart game at the time. Nobody knew where he stood. And so he was like a good manager who was going to be able to at least do some fight back. He was very good, and he continued to receive protection from various people within Russia who wanted to fight back, who didn't want to continue to be torn to pieces. And this is what Zbigniew Brzezinski, you know, he wrote his grand chessboard in 97, where he outlined a map of what Russia was going to look like in his idealized world, which was a divided Russia of like three separate federations, all controlled by a central banking system that was affiliated or controlled by London. So it was very, very, very Balkanized. Everything was Balkanized. And so there's been a 20-year fight under Putin to expel a lot of this poison that was brought in the 90s. A lot of these oligarchs have escaped prison in Russia by going to a safer haven in London. That's why they call a section of London where all of the Russian oligarchs live Moscow on the Thames, where they have all their mansions, because they if they go to Russia, they're going to go to jail. Now, in China's case, and this gets at your original question, what about, like, how do you think about China, right? Both of them. How do you think about Russia? How do you think about China? They do seem to be fighting against this Great Reset agenda. If you look at the Great Reset agenda, it's committed to two things primarily: depopulation, reducing the world population to acceptable standards of what computer models say, usually I think the consensus is about a billion. And getting rid of nation states as an institution to create new supranational organizations. This is the stakeholder capitalism, is that that's basically a euphemism for world government. That's what COP26 is all about.
Sorry, so, but real quick, yeah. I'll just,
yeah.
But China has been a huge tool of these globalists. They took all of the manufacturing and economic might of America, allowed China to steal all the intellectual property and all the military intellectual, power and so forth.
Okay.
Reverse engineer all the military stuff. So they've been taking power away from America, giving it to China. But now, go ahead, continue.
Yeah. So when Kissinger went to China, how much time do we have? Because I'm going to...
No, keep going.
Yeah, okay. I wrote a paper, a long paper going through this. It's a chapter of my new book called How the Chinese Gorbachev was flushed in 1989. From 1970-71, when the Trilateral Commission under Kissinger began to really organize the Entente with Mao during the culture, this is at the height of the Cultural Revolution, which was run by Mao and a group called the Gang of Four. The Gang of Four were largely courtiers. One of them was Mao's wife, but these were like really psychopathic clique, and they ran. They basically had the idea of just resetting 2,000 years or more of Chinese civilization in like a small decade. Getting rid of intellectuals, getting rid of all Western contamination of Western ideas and Western music and science, and just getting all the intellectuals to just like go to the field and like farm with like their hands for in their world, it was indefinite. Like that was supposed to be the forever model, right? That was not supposed to be a 10-year thing. That was going to be a forever thing. and that was supposed to purify China by cutting it off of the past under a great reset. And then reconstruct the entire Chinese zeitgeist under a new model run by social engineers. And again, that was supposed to be in Kissinger's mind going in, when that was the forever model. China was going to be this fixed state of a hyper-feudalist place. And they would have, under that structure, zones on the coastal lines where they would use super cheap labor to produce things to export to consumer markets. Because the idea was, how do we transform America's productive economy into a consumer cult, which was this time bomb I was talking about earlier. That was always the idea. And you know, part of it, you could think of H.G. Wells's Time Machine, where you have the, because these guys, they write their guidelines, their blueprints to coordinate themselves as an oligarchical elite in the form sometimes of fiction, like Brave New World or The Time Machine is another one, where you have like the Morlocks and you have the LOI in the future, right? And the Morlocks are these like dirty subhuman people who do all of the production of industry. And then you have like the LOI, who are these like beautiful people who occasionally get eaten by Morlocks. And then you have unspoken, you know, these social engineers managing everything. So in the Kissinger model, the world was supposed to be divided by two cultures, the productive, dirty people who would be remaining poor, always too poor to purchase the things that they were producing. And then the like first world consumer dumb blobs who would just consume in dollar stores and cheapen themselves, but not be productive. And that type of world, nobody would be sovereign, right? Because we would always be addicted to greater rates of cheap shit from China or Mexico or other places, right? So things like the deregulation of protection, the shutting down of protectionism, the deregulation of the financial system that allowed for the mergers and acquisitions of the 1980s, the creation of universal banking, too big to fails, all came out of, because too big to fails couldn't happen if you had national regulation on your banking sector the way we used to have. You couldn't do the too big to fails. If you gambled and you were a bank and you failed. No one's going to bail you out. So this whole thing became the model that Kissinger aimed at, okay? And part of it was subverted. So in China's case, in the 70s, Mao dies, and the enemies of the Gang of Four. So there's a guy who was a good guy named Zhou Enlai. Zhou Enlai was a figure who really was an anti-imperialist. He created the Bandung Conference of non-aligned movements, non-aligned nations in the 50s. He was an enemy of the Gang of Four. The Gang of Four always hated this guy because he wanted a China based on industrial progress, cooperation with other nations. Like he wasn't part of their mindset. So he had a faction that took power under Deng Xiaoping in when Mao dies. Immediately, the first thing that Deng Xiaoping and this group does is they jail the Gang of Four. They give the Chinese the right to criticize Mao, because Mao was formerly treated kind of like a godhead. It was very unhealthy. And Deng said, okay, we're allowed. We can treat him like a human being. We can criticize things like the Cultural Revolution or the Great Leap Forward. We can criticize these things. These were bad. So that was like the first sort of spiritual sort of like healing process beginning. But Kissinger and the David Rockefeller group, they never gave up on that vision of the China as the permanent dirty Morlocks producing for the West. And throughout the 1980s, there was a big fight. And in my paper, I zero in on the figure of George Soros's man in China, who became the secretary general of the Chinese Communist Party for 2 years from 87 to 89, named Zhao Ziyang. And Zhao Ziyang co-ran a think tank with George Soros in China, co-ran, and he sponsored another think tank for new Chinese economic thinking or something, with a whole clique of kind of like what happened with Russia in the 1990s is what happened around Zhao Ziyang. So he was kind of like the Gorbachev for China. And he was bringing in the Club of Rome. He was bringing in Milton Friedman, met with him several times. Alvin Toffler, the futurist transhumanist, met with him in China. And they were all like, this is the golden boy, man. This is going to be the guy. He's our guy who's going to bring in this transhumanist sort of idea. And he was also creating foundations to send groups of talented young Chinese economists to study at Harvard and Yale, to be indoctrinated and be brought back as young technocrats and oligarchs. So it was big. And in 89, there was an attempt to put him in full power of China and expel any of the patriotic Chinese nationalists from power in the CPC. And that was 1989. That became Tiananmen Square. And Tiananmen Square was not supposed to be just one event. The idea was that was the first step to initiate a regime change, a color revolution, kind of like what had happened in Philippines at the same time that ousted Marcos and brought in a Soros Malik Brown asset named Cory Aquino. But so the idea was, okay, Zhao Ziyang was going to be the man of the people. The students were going to strike, but there were, just like in the case of Ukraine in 2014 or 13, there were, it was run by the CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy. It was run by the American Embassy, who was the ambassador for China at that time, was a trilateral commission CIA asset, who worked very closely with Bush Senior, who was also running the CIA for a long time. And that was quickly turned in. There were agents provocateurs with weapons, with Molotov cocktails, who killed several dozen PLA officers during that time. Now, the most of the students were peaceful, but you had these like these third elements all of a sudden just appear doing crazy shit, trying to just provoke. They wanted to get some sort of a mass reaction by the Chinese government, which, by the way, all of the claims that you find of these big numbers of like 10,000 people died at Tiananmen, it's all just numbers that were thrown out. If you actually look for evidence, it's all just claims made by very nefarious Western intelligence agencies that repeated the claims and embedded them into our psyche. But their actual number is more like maybe 200 or so. And a lot of them were, again, PLA soldiers themselves. And there's pictures of their bodies burnt alive. It's crazy. It'll turn your stomach. All that to say, Zhao Ziyang was supposed to be the man of the people, who was going to come out and be supported for the cleansing of the Chinese Communist Party. And he was going to be installed as the guy. Now he was ousted. They did not react violently the way they were expected to. And they basically ousted Soros. So China then expelled Soros, arrested all of Yi Zi, all of the key guys who were working with Soros and Milton Friedman and all these guys. They arrested those who they could. Those who they couldn't arrest escaped to the United States, where they became sort of the foreign base of operations, running things like, you know, later on Falun Gong. The Epoch Times are largely managed by a lot of these characters, unfortunately. And Zhao Ziyang was placed under house arrest, where he died 15 years later at his house. So they were basically, the Chinese were able to cut off earlier on the worst elements of this Soros Kissinger thing that had taken, that Russia was slower on the uptake. Russia, they went deeper into the hole. So China was able to
That's
maintain.
very surprising to hear you describe it that way, because me looking back over the last few decades at the transfer of wealth and manufacturing and intellectual property to China, you would think that the CCP was completely under the thumb of the globalists.
Well, like I said, they were more under the control by far in the 70s and 80s. There has been a fight, though, and it continues to be a fight. It's not like there's like one singular China at this point. There's a fight even within the CCP. Now, they learned from Western techniques for a period. The thing, though, in the recent years, especially since the Belt and Road Initiative has taken off, what you've seen is that China has learned from copying for a long time. But now they're producing all these things like, you know, magnetic levitation rail, new, like they've got more patents for high-speed rail tech than any other country, including Japan, quantum computing and nuclear science and tech. So they've gone like now beyond what any human beings, any members of the human species have experienced so far. And now they're pioneering. And during that time in the 40-year period of globalization from 70 to, you know, 2010, it's a pirate. I mean, the whole thing was everybody is like fighting behind the scenes with everybody else. Like it's chaos. There's not like nations. There's no, like we turn on the news and we're told about nation states doing this or that. It's not the case.
Sure. It's not super unified, but I've seen and heard that, and I was working in China too, you know, they've institutionalized kind of an anti-humanity kind of thing with the forced abortions, with organ harvesting.
Okay. Here's one thing on the forced abortions thing. The one child policy was an atrocity, right? I think we can all agree on that. Now, that was actually a Club of Rome, because Club of Rome, with founded by Alexander King and Aurelio Pichai, were co-founders as well of, they presented the earliest World Economic Forum meetings, summits. This group created the original limits to growth thesis as sort of a neo-Malthusian computer model that was took Malthus but then incorporated computing into it, right, and made it more of a science. Now the key guy, Song Jian, I think is his name, was a cybernetics systems analysis figure, very high level in China, who studied in Finland at Club of Rome meetings and brought back the Club of Rome model that he repackaged. And it was through that it was marketed to the Chinese to say, okay, we're going to have this population crisis. We have to act now. These are the computer models to prove it, all Club of Rome. And I think Kissinger's NSSM 200 report as well, that justified turning the US foreign policy in 1974, 75 from being pro-industrial progress to poor countries into population control to take the resources. The NSSM National Security Study Memorandum 200. This was a part of that design as well. And I think that there was a documentary that went through how in order for China to receive the necessary money, because they were very poor, is very feudal after the Cultural Revolution, super poor. But they needed desperately money to basically maintain themselves and support their people in the late 70s. Part of the condition was that they had to bring in the one-child policy as a condition to get the technology and to become a recipient of the Western productive techniques. Now in the last, since 2015, they've reversed this. So they got rid of the one child policy officially in 2015-16. Now it's up to three child policy. So they're trying to heal. The point is that I'm trying to get at is just that they're trying to heal and recuperate the damage that was done, inflicted to themselves. And also, they never did the one child. That was only to the Han population. There's several population groups in China, but like the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, I forget the other ones.
You mentioned a couple important groups there that kind of go along with this line of thinking that I've been talking about, which is an anti-humanity philosophy.
Well, what I'm saying is that they never had the one child policy. Like the Uyghurs never had one child policy. They could have
I'm looking at the drone footage of loading them on trains and sent to re-education camps. You know, the Tibetans have their own culture and their own religion, and they were mowed down with machine guns and forced to be under a government that they didn't want to be under. So I'm just saying, like, I'm not getting the impression from the Chinese that they're somehow independent of the deep state, except for their suffered this like public spat with George Soros recently.
No, it's not the public spat though. And I mean, look, the Chinese under the Belt and Road Initiative, if you actually look at what this thing has done, it's pulled 900 million people out of poverty by emitting long-term credit for big projects that are 10 to 20 years in duration, like huge things that America used to do. We stopped doing it 50 years ago. China as well as Russia together as an integrated unit have 130 countries that they're building the biggest things in the world. It's like $3 trillion of investments that are literally building full spectrum economics. They're creating cadres in Nigeria and Kenya of engineers, which no empires don't create educational facilities for engineering in cultures that they want to rape and pillage. They just bring in their own units and corporations to steal and rape and pillage resources, leaving nothing for people in Africa. That's never what the IMF has permitted. Whereas in China, they've created tens of thousands of engineers and they're building up infrastructure to allow for the creation of industrial manufacturing in these countries for the first time. So you have an this goes totally against the Great Reset calculus completely by empowering
maybe
small
you
nations.
Can speak on yeah. the whole biological war aspect of COVID-19 then, because this is a depopulation agenda.
Yes.
Supposedly originated in China. The Chinese control the manufacturing of most of the pharmaceuticals, the protective equipment. Seems like the Chinese have a lot more, you know, when you question these things and you come up with these questions like who benefits, it seems like China has benefited more than anyone else besides the stockholders of these pharma companies in this COVID-19 bioweapon scenario.
Well, look, the thing I would say here is that China, I don't see how they benefited so much. The idea of...
Well, when their main adversary gets cut down to its knees economically and we're locking ourselves down, they were all open and celebrating. They didn't lock down nearly as much as we did in the West. And they sold all the protective equipment to the West, right? Because they are the one producing it. And the fact that they even have a chokehold on all of these important infrastructure level things, it's just, to me, it's an unconventional war going on with China and the US and so forth.
Well, here's the thing.
Where the deep state is all aligned with all of their objectives of depopulation and so forth.
China doesn't allow in the mRNA, like none of their vaccines, because they're not mRNA. My big issue mRNA.
Sorry, real quick though. They co-patented Remdesivir, which is the only approved medicine for or treatment for COVID in the United States, and is causing people to die.
It's the question of who's making the policy of where this thing is going. The point of production is not what makes the policy of how it's used. If somebody builds a bomb, doesn't mean that they're going to be making the military policy. It's going to use a bomb in a certain way. I would look at number one, the US has within it 11 BSL-4 labs, and internationally, there's about 200 international bioweapons facilities that nobody's looking at. They're totally opaque. A lot of them are around Russia's perimeter and around China's perimeter. A lot of them are in South America, but most of them are around Russia. These are international. I haven't seen anybody except a couple of journalists talking about them. And in 2018, a lot of these, several of these labs around Russia were found stealing Russian Slavic genotypes from Russian laboratories and doing all sorts of weird shit. The US has a history, the Anglo-American sort of deep state thing has a history going back to the BioShield Act of 2004 under Cheney and the anthrax attacks that were undone by the United States, by a faction within the FBI and the CIA to create sort of an excuse to justify the BioShield Act that put $50 billion into clandestine, mostly bioweapons gain of function research. China has one BSL-4 lab and it is in Wuhan. But at the same time, I'd be like, okay, what the hell? Why are we not looking at all of the other ones? What were the military games all about in Wuhan that brought, all of the military there in 2019? We do seem to have evidence of COVID-19 having been found in Western sewage systems in Europe, in France. We found it in people who had come down sick as early as September of 2019 in the United States. There's a lot I don't know. I'm just saying, like, there's a lot
actually,
of anomalies.
It seemed to be this epicenters in Italy, where you had the most Chinese people going, and New York, where you had the most Chinese people going.
Italy is where you had the most old people. I mean, like, the fact is, the thing that caused
also
all of the problems
the
in
Italy... the
largest
population of Chinese people in northern Italy.
Yeah, dude, the only thing that caused all these people to die and to have all these problems was the fact that there was a systematic policy across a lot of old elderly centers, residences, that killed people by stuffing COVID patients into elderly homes.
And you had democratic politicians saying, come down to Chinatown and be in a nice parade with us, you know, and when Trump was trying to shut down air travel from China, they were all saying, no, that's racist. So
yeah, sure.
I'm seeing an alliance between the deep state and China here, you know, and I mentioned atrocities against Tibetans and Uyghurs, but there's the fact that people can't search for things on the internet because they don't have an internet in China. They have this very limited intranet where you can only search for government approved things. You can't celebrate your own religion. You know, if you want to, I had to sign a contract when I went to China. I wasn't allowed to mention Christianity to Chinese people. So it's very, very tyrannical there.
Look, there's a lot of fallacies you're throwing out at me, man. I mean, I don't know what to say.
Go ahead, address each one, you know, because, you know, go ahead.
Okay. Look, in the case of, I've got tons of friends who are Christian in China. I don't know where you're saying that you're not allowed to be Christian in China. There's tons of churches. No, I've got
as
friends
a foreigner,
who are Christian.
You're not allowed to.
You can't proselytize, but you can
go
to a church.
You can't share your religious beliefs with other people.
No, you can. You can have study groups. You can have, like, you can go to churches. The thing that you can't, the problem is that they had a lot of front groups going back throughout the entire 20th century, utilizing Christianity as a front group for Western intelligence to undermine and conduct.
Okay, now you can try to justify their control of the internet.
Well, here's a problem. I mean, the internet is not a neutral place. Facebook, big tech, all these things are part of, as we just discovered, they were part of the overthrow of the United States under when Trump was ousted. That was a regime change that was conducted through the work of big tech, big media.
You are pro central control over information?
No, but at the same time, you're not in a state where nation states exist in a vacuum. There are like active, hardcore, ongoing warfare operations on a variety of levels to destroy nations from within. And so a lot of the policies you're seeing are being done as part of defensive, not offensive, operation within Eurasian countries that are seeing that they will be destroyed and dismantled the way Zbigniew Brzezinski outlined for both Russia and China.
It just seems like this authoritarianism is completely in line with the philosophy that you in detail described selfishness, ego-based, you know, not allowing people to make their own decisions. That's what this Chinese system really seems to be to me.
Look, as far as the pulling people out of poverty, increasing actual powers of nation states to coexist and set, like, standing up for the multipolar, which is sovereign nation state system, instead of a unipolar one world government. China is fighting that fight. And as far as the Uyghur thing is concerned, look, they got a border with Afghanistan and they've had hundreds of terrorist attacks in China's soil going back to the 90s. That are all being funded by Western CIA, MI6, and Saudi operations within the Middle East. That's something that's proven. It's not me just making a claim. You could prove that that's the case. And the two different approaches that the West is
taking... So do you think re-education camps are a good idea for Uyghurs?
It's tough. I mean, like, right now, bombing the countries back to the Stone Age, like we did for Iraq and Libya and Afghanistan, is not the right thing to do, but we did that. We got Guantanamo Bay. I mean, we're very self-righteous, considering how much damage we've done to the Muslim world by bombing their countries. The idea of China not bombing countries and instead offering development aid to countries, and if their re-education... Like, here's the thing. There's a huge radicalized, hardcore separatist movement funded by the Saudis and also the Turks to a certain degree, but mostly the Saudis, called the East Turkestan, Turkmenistan Fighters Groups, which doesn't believe in Xinjiang. They believe that that's a separate entity and they are working with Al Qaeda. They cut their teeth fighting alongside Al Qaeda in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan for over two decades. These are hardcore, many of them hardcore terrorists, highly indoctrinated. And this has infiltrated China throughout the 1970s all the way up. Well, mostly through the 80s when Zbigniew Brzezinski unleashed the Mujahideen policies, you know, under Operation Cyclone, which was what the US did to put taxpayer money in funding radical Islamic groups that became Al Qaeda to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. That's where this group, part of that was the Muslims in the Uyghur Muslims. Part of that was, they were part of that formula. The Gang of Four actually helped with that. So China has had this whole thing inside of their own underbelly as a Western operation to create chaos. That's something that they had to deal with. The way that they're doing it right now, I mean, is a lot of economic development. There's a lot of slander. I mean, if you actually look at what the hell is going on, there are re-education camps, but it's not like concentration camps. They do actually are teaching like civics, like trade. They're giving people trades and putting them to work by building big infrastructure projects. And I've seen like tons of interviews with tons of people all over Xinjiang who are speaking very well of this. I can't speak for the things that I don't like. I don't know about a lot of the elements of the re-education camps, but I know it's better than bombing countries to the Stone Age. It's a tough situation because you got these international oligarchical instruments that are funding terrorism, that are creating terrorism. And it makes like a false debate between you and me right now about terrorism as if it was some indigenously occurring thing. And it's like, it's not. It's a created instrument.
Well, there are ethnic and language groups that want self-determination, and China obviously didn't respect that in Tibet.
Okay, well, here's the thing with Tibet. I mean, there's a whole can of worms. Okay, Tibet in the 1950s under the Dalai Lama, it had a literacy rate of about less than 30%. The average life expectancy was about 32 years of age. It was very, very low. It was a democracy, a priest class. So everybody worked.
China should go in with automatic weapons and colonize them and say, hey, you have to be under China now because you don't have high enough literacy rates.
No. But at the same time, I don't think that you could extrapolate everything that China did in the past into the present. It's not the same thing. It's not like what happened generations ago. This is why I say, like, people who think that the Cultural Revolution is still the operating dynamic, they're living in an illusion. They're taking elements from like 50 plus years ago and transposing that into today because a bunch of McCarthyite witch hunters who want to, you know, get us to think like we were in the Cold War.
I'm also just looking at the Chinese policy of stealing intellectual property, of buying up our politicians.
Keep it on one thing. On terms of the Tibet, like if you look at the educational curricula, they did not wipe out the Tibetan language. They're teaching that the Tibetan languages. They're to be teaching Tibetan songs and cultures. There's community centers now all over the place and cultural centers where Tibetans practice and perform all of their indigenous. It wasn't wiped out. There was no ethnic genocide there. But more importantly, the average life expectancy has risen to 69 years of age on average in a very quick period of time. The amount of education and economic development that's pulled people into poverty without wiping out their cultural groups is amazingly high. And I think that if you talk to most people living in Tibet, and I've seen tons of interviews with people all over Tibet, you don't get the same thing as Western privileged people speaking through a filter of anti-China thought control who are commenting about what's going on in Tibet, but people on Tibet on the ground are very happy with the development.
People who their official religion is Tibetan Buddhism and the leader of their religion isn't allowed to go and be at their sacred places because the communist government doesn't allow him to be there.
It's more complicated. The Dalai Lama and his brothers were funded by the CIA in the 1950s as part of a balkanization process to destroy and undermine China in the 50s. That's again provable that the CIA were providing weapons, funding, logistics to the Dalai Lama's network to undermine and break up China.
To defend.
The CIA was not about defending anybody in the 1950s. They were about regime change.
But it was China who attacked Tibet. It wasn't like Tibet left and went and attacked Beijing.
Tibet was never going to be left alone. The CIA was going to run it no matter what if China wasn't. Like the whole thing was to carve up the world during the Cold War period under CIA MI6 zones of influence versus communist zones of influence. And the whole Cold War, This is why I say, like, we get stuck fighting in these artificial debates because the Cold War itself should never have happened. If you look at what people like Henry Wallace, Franklin Roosevelt's vice president, was organizing for in 1944, 45, what Roosevelt was organizing for was a Russia, US, China alliance to be the bedrock for the post-war age of anti-imperialism and win-win cooperation. And there were programs laid out, which both Mao as well as Chiang Kai-shek, who was at the time, it wasn't determined which one was going to lead China, but both of them had agreed on these programs for massive infrastructure development with the help of Russia and the United States, South America, Africa. There were programs to green the Sahara Desert that were all agreed upon at the Bretton Woods Conference in 44. So this was the momentum, and the British Empire was going to be dismantled. That was what FDR was completely committed to, dismantling the institution of empire and bringing a new era into being. And this is what was destroyed with the creation of Churchill's Iron Curtain speech and the Anglo-American alliance, right, that reconsolidated this Rhodes Trust thing in America and empowered it, that killed Kennedy, that Eisenhower warned about in his military industrial complex speech. But the US was really, we should have been in a different place. So because the Cold War happened, it created this artificial fucking schizophrenia around the world where we now get caught in these fights where it's like nobody was good and nobody was bad.
Everybody
did wrong things.
Glad that I brought up these points because, you know, this is the way a lot of people in the West view communist authoritarian countries. It's not just China, you know, it's North Korea, a place where, you know, it's a feudal system where people work hard labor as punishment and they use most of their economy for the military. And it's not a good place to be. There's not a lot of freedom or high quality of life in North Korea.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you go to China, you look at their money, it's got Mao's face on it. This is the guy, you know, that did the great leap forward in the Cultural Revolution. It's like, it's this weird communist authoritarian thing that injected a whole bunch of capitalism in it to bring people up. So this great, they're not in poverty like in the 70s anymore, but they're still pretty much holding on to the godless communist authoritarian philosophy, it seems to me.
Well, China's going through what's called a classical. So there's the classics are being revived and it's a 2000 plus year tradition. Confucianism right now is big. So the practice and study of Confucius's thinking, especially in the works of Mencius, they're huge. And there's like Confucius cultural centers being set up all over the place. If you read Confucius, it's very much in alignment with Christianity, the best of Christianity. In terms of love thy neighbor, do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you, is Confucius's golden rule. Very similar to, it's like a negative version of the do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that co-evolved separately, you know, 500 years before Christ. The principle of agape, the love of humanity, is represented in the Confucian principle of Ren. The principle of Li in Confucius's world is very similar to the principle of a divine principle or spirit that animates all things. So it's not this atheistic mechanical thing that's there. There is a fight within China, within various cultural groups, that just like here in the West, right? We got atheistic, nihilistic thought matrices at war with Judeo-Christian principles at the same time, right? That express themselves in different ways. You have it in Russia too. So you have it in India. The thing that I'm seeing right now is that, like, you do have an attempt to China's create, like, the quality of China's ability to create, to make things happen that uplift people out of poverty, but also introduce creative changes by introducing new discoveries onto the system, breaks all rules of formulas of mathematical models that otherwise empires want to use to control us, is a mathematical way of thinking. A new discovery is outside of the mathematical formula. It doesn't exist in the computer model. That's why they're banned. New discoveries are banned from a technocratic way of being. Whereas in the case of China, what I'm seeing directly is like 500 new cities, advanced cities are being built with high speed. They've got 30,000 kilometers of high speed rail. You know, like the idea of space-time is compressing, where it would take, you know, for me to go to New York from Montreal, like something like 9 hours on a current train using the 1960s technology that we have, it would take them the same thing about an hour and a half. So they're also doing this with a certain policy internationally of inviting the West to work with them, which up until the Wuhan, COVID-19, Trump was moving in that direction. He was calling many times for cooperation with China and with Russia as the bedrock of world cooperation. And it was really just the COVID-19 thing that changed that. That changed his perspective, perceptions on things. But before that, I think that was what was really scaring people like Lord Malik Brown and Soros. Because when Soros came out first attacking China, he used to like China when China was still like more something that they thought that they could control in 2011, 2012. I mean, they were still thinking that China was definitely something that they had a handle on. Soros was speaking still well of China, despite the fact that China had kicked him out in 89, right? But then in January 2020 at Davos, he said the two biggest threats to his open society are Trump's USA and Xi Jinping's Belt and Road.
Right.
And those two things had to be crushed for his open society to work.
All of this tension in this conversation for the last few minutes have been based on this idea that there is this perspective that I was putting forth that China's aligned with this selfish deep state philosophy. But you're saying, no, actually, that they have more of the nationalistic sovereignty type of that they're allied with that philosophy.
That's my intention.
Yeah. So who do you think are the counterforces to the deep state? You've got China, you know, Russia, Trump's alliance, whatever you call them. Anyone else worth mentioning?
I think when you Iran is increasingly like, look, Iran has just joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Keep in mind, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is one aspect of the multipolar alliance. The multipolar alliance is the alliance of nations who are committed to the view of sovereign nations, like multiple poles of policy, instead of just the unipolar, which is one pole telling nations how to step in a line. So Iran represents an old civilization. Pakistan is a part of that with the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. They're also part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They're working on big projects. They just signed a $400 billion 25-year project with Iran and China. Russia is also integrating their energy grids, and they have a 20-year investment project with Iran as well, which had formerly been very isolated for a long time. So you have these old civilizations, Islam, Persian, Confucian, Christian, Orthodox from Russia, sort of doing what Zbigniew Brzezinski said, or Samuel P. Huntington, right? Even better, another trilateral commission freak, said could never happen, because they're of the view that civilizations must clash. Different cultures can do not but clash. That's what Steve Bannon is also saying. It's the destiny of the Christian world to clash with the Muslim world and the Confucian world. No, they're actually demonstrating that when you act with a higher set of self-interest based on universal characteristics of what makes us human, which is we're all going to die, we all want a better life for our kids by building things like water systems and other things that make life better for kids after we die. That's what real economics should be about. What, you know, Kennedy or JFK or Lincoln, they had that orientation about economics long-term. So you have a lot of that. You have many countries in South America who are sort of being pulled in two different directions. But, you know, Africa too, I think something like 48 of the 54 African nations have signed on a different memorandum of agreements with China to break away from the IMF, World Bank, Western imperial controls. But I think really,
so it's really a global thing where every nation, state, and every people is making that decision about whether they're going to ally with the globalists or be sovereign.
Yeah, like right now, the COP26, I mean, look, China and India together, we're told about all of the conflicts between China and India, but in reality, like, India has to make a decision, but together, China and India saved us in 2009 at COP14. People forget that COP14 was a world government agenda conference with Sarkozy and Merkel and Gordon Brown and everybody, and the idea was, you know, we were going to come out of this in November 2009 with binding world government carbon reduction treaties that every nation would be forced to behold into under world government controls to enforce.
Like a Paris Accord type of thing.
Exactly. That's what that was. The Paris Accord was the attempt to revive what failed in 2009. So why did it fail? Because India and China together locked themselves in a room and didn't participate in anything. They said, no, we're not fucking coming out. We're not signing shit. And I'm sorry if I'm swearing
on the
platform.
Go ahead. Yeah, no problem.
Okay. And they basically, the whole thing tanked, completely tanked. And it became a total failure. Paris was done to try to revive that. Still didn't quite work because ultimately China and India don't want to depopulate. They don't, you know, and that's what this whole decarbonization thing is. If you get rid of coal and natural gas and oil and in the effort to save the environment from human beings, to stop this imaginary global warming from happening, which is actually not happening. We're going into an ice age. Fun fact. Then you're actually going to reduce, you're going to kill our ability to sustain life. That's really what the goal has always been about with demonizing carbon dioxide. It's like, we're carbon dioxide machines. As human beings, carbon dioxide, right? They want to legalize that, right?
No more breathing.
Why, no more breathing. No, you're going to have a breathing tax. And that's what they're doing to these nations, is it's a breathing tax. When they say carbon tax, it's a breathing tax for nations, because you're saying, okay, you're going to have to pay money to produce things that your population needs to sustain life. That's what they're going to constrict, like a 32-inch waist belt down to like a 3-inch waist belt. And they want to try to do that as fast as possible. And now they're bringing in COVID as another invisible enemy. So they had one invisible enemy demonized by computer models called CO2. People weren't buying that. And now they brought in another one this is what the Great Reset is all about, right? And COP26 is about like taking COVID-19, fake invisible enemy, and mixing it with global warming, CO2 destruction, another invisible enemy, taking it as one thing, and now creating under COP26 coming up a new world government. But again, the head of COP26, the president, who's an Indian guy whose name I forget, has been saying, like, he's really afraid that China's going to boycott. And, you know, China was they're probably going to send a delegation, but their approach to getting to decarbonizing is very different from the West. They're saying, okay, if we're going to decarbonize, it's going to be through, they're still investing massively in natural gas and coal, but also nuclear power. They're doing the thing that we used to build nuclear power. We stopped back 50 years ago. It was all shut down by the Trilateral Commission. So they're saying, okay, let's do it in a way that's going to allow us to sustain more people at a higher quality of life. Whereas in the West, under the Green New Deal crap or Build Back Better for the World that Biden's pushing as an anti-BRI, it's all about solar panels, windmills, and shutting down industrial civilization to kill people. Very different.
And nobody's allowed to be on an airplane and do no. air travel and
no
yeah just
no.
limit our freedoms.
Yes,
you know, we got into a lot of historical context. I guess that would happen with a historian like yourself. I'm really happy that we got to tease out the stuff regarding the CCP and China, because you have a different perspective from mine, and you know, I'm used to these types of tensions because I used to teach English to a lot of Russian people and people who live in different areas, and I would have to acknowledge a lot of the propaganda that I had, the programming I had in my own culture about who is Vladimir Putin, you know, the Russian system, how does it work, you know, that culture compared to my own culture and stuff. So it's really interesting to get your perspective on China as a force for good globally, whereas I was always seeing their Belt and Road Initiative as just a way to extract, you know, value from other countries. So it's very interesting to get that perspective. I would like to do a part two with you maybe next week, where we could go into how these two different forces that we discussed are going to come into some sort of ultimate conflict and climax and a disintegration. And then there's going to have to be a victory by one side or the other, and a new system created. And I believe it's going to be the system of love and sovereignty and all of that good stuff. So what would that look like? What would that financial system look like? You know, what would back it and all of those things? So maybe, I'm sure we won't be able to get into all of that in the next one. We'll probably talk about just the conflict aspect of it. But hey, maybe in part three, we can talk about the next one.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a nice cliffhanger. Okay.
Great. All right. Well, people can check out your website where you post your articles as Canadian Patriot.
Yeah, it's CanadianPatriot.org. And the other one that people might enjoy for some more cultural, uplifting, edifying stuff is RisingTideFoundation.net, which is a nonprofit I co-founded with my wife. Those two things are good. And also, oh yeah, my Substack. So people can support my writing, my work by either buying my books, which are on my website, or subscribing to my Substack, which is MatthewErritt.substack. I think that's how it works. .com maybe.
Yes. I read your recent Substack about the time bomb. You're amazing writer. You know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to interview you today. So, definitely check out. I'm going to put in the description below the links to those three sites.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me on, man.
You bet.
All right.
Gold is near all-time highs. Has it reached its peak? Did you miss the boat? No, I don't think so. The exploding debt, change in the interest rate cycle, political and economic turmoil have caused the current move in gold. And those things are getting worse. In fact, Citibank projected gold to hit $3,000 an ounce over the next 12 to 18 months. I encourage you to protect and grow your investment portfolio with gold. I trust Dr. Kirk Elliott with Sovereign Advisors. With over 25 years of experience and two PhDs, Kirk Elliott is the best of the best in the industry. Call his office at 720-605-3900 and tell him Sean Morgan sent you, or just click on the link in the description to get that free consultation.